When the mind's too quick and the dream's too slow, and you can't pretend to feel, and your life has gone on its own somehow, and you long for something real, come to me.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is a recorded edition with wonderful stuff nevertheless. Our guest, rebroadcast from a year and a half ago, Kim Stanley Robinson. Stay tuned. Once again, good morning. As mentioned, this is a recorded edition of Hour of the Wolf, recording it on the morning of broadcast, so we're pretty au courant, as it were. And while the roads may be plowed and clear, parking is still not easy. Can't say about up at CCNY, where the WBAI studio in the crypt is located. However, where I am, once I leave here, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to park again and just, you know, rove around the neighborhood like Charlie in the Streets of Boston, being the person who never returned or something like that. Well, I figured a recorded program would be safer this way. And for this week, I have chosen an interview, first broadcast about a year and a half ago, September of 2013, with one of my favorite writers, Kim Stanley Robinson, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I have something to promote, and that is the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading series, which the next edition of is this coming Tuesday, February 3rd. And it's located at Gallery Lala, or the Soho Gallery of Digital Art, depending on where you choose to put it. But one way or the other, it's at 138 Sullivan Street, a few steps down between Houston and Prince. And we have two wonderful, wonderful writers. Regular listeners to the show may well have heard both. Carlos Hernandez is somebody who I first met when Delia Sherman brought him on the program when she was working on Interfictions. And he is a writer with over 30 publication credits in a variety of genres, fiction recently published in Crossed Genres and Antimatter, and an SF one-act play published in Geek Theater. By day, Carlos is a CUNY Associate Professor of English with appointments at BMCC and the CUNY Graduate Center, and a game designer currently working as the lead writer on the Lewis and Clark CRPG Merryweather, now in beta. Not sure what a CRPG is. I know what an RPG is. Well, he lives in Queens, which he says is most notable for not being Brooklyn. Well, I lived my first 40 years in Queens, in the same neighborhood, as a matter of fact, as Carlos, so I'm not going to say anything bad. I love that neighborhood. Jennifer Marie Brissett, is a writer, artist, former bookstore owner, and a former web developer. She is a Jamaican British American who emigrated to the U.S. when she was about 4 and grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In her late 20s, she moved to Brooklyn. Yeah, there we go, Brooklyn again. Where, for 3.5 years, she owned and ran the indie bookstore Indigo Cafe and Books, which was a very special place. She has a master's in creative writing from the Stone Coast MFA program and a bachelor's in interdisciplinary engineering. That's electrical engineering with a concentration in visual art from Boston University. Her writing has been included in The Best of Halfway Down the Stairs, 2005-2010, and a finalist for the 2013 Story South Million Writers Award. Her debut novel, Elysium, published by Aqueduct Press, has been shortlisted for the 2014 Philip K. Dick Award. And that's really thrilling. That's really great. Jen was on the program just about when the novel came out, and it has been getting fabulous reviews and a lot of notable notices. So one of the other thrilling things, which she didn't mention in her bio that I just read, was that there was an article, 33 most needed audiobooks, not put out in 2013, and Elysium, her novel, was number one on that list. So, yay. So this is a really good duo, both people that were at one time or another involved with the same writers group as Rick Bowes and other people who've been on the program, and we hope you'll come. Admission is free. We do beg for donations at the door. But if you can't afford it, come anyway. It's next Tuesday, February 3rd. Doors will open about 6:30. If you come a little early, you can shop around on the upper floor of Gallery Lala and then descend into the cellar. The cabaret is what I call it. And enjoy two very fine readers. And here's one more note. A listener by the name of Barry sent me an email alerting me to the fact that Turner Classic Movies is going to be broadcasting a film called Twice Upon a Time, a 1983 seldom seen animated film produced by George Lucas, including voices such as our own Marshall Efron and Hamilton Camp and Lorenzo Semple, a lot of really good people, using some kind of stop animation involving cutouts. Okay. I tell the entire story of how I met Stan Robinson in the interview. This was a Skype recorded interview, and that's something I really don't care to do. I really, really, really prefer one-on-one interviews, where face-to-face is what I mean by that. Because there's a rapport issue, but this was the third time I had interviewed Stan, and he is always an exception. And he had a new book out in late 2013, and that provided a good excuse for an interview. He has so many books, so many series that are well worthwhile. A couple of collections of short stories, The Planet of the Table, Escape from Kathmandu, Remaking History, came out in 1991. He has a book called Antarctica, which is a place where he has spent time in order to research some of his writing. Pacific Edge, The Gold Coast, The Wild Shore, The Years of Rice and Salt, 40 Signs of Rain, 50 Degrees Below. But my personal favorite is probably Red Mars, which is still to date, even though it came out in 1993, and between the time that he wrote it and the time it came into print, certain things were found out about permafrost and, you know, science moves on. But the politics of it are fabulous and wonderful, as well as the science. And this series of books, Red Mars, Green Mars, and Blue Mars, are an epic in the grandest sense of the word. If you needed to start in any one place, I would say Red Mars. And trust me, you will be hooked. So enough from me. Let's listen to this interview recorded a year and a half ago with Kim Stanley Robinson. This is Jim Freund. I'm speaking with Kim Stanley Robinson on the afternoon of the 24th, 3 hours difference, because you're in California and I'm here in New York. And this is, I think, you probably don't remember, this is actually our third interview. One time being a very long time ago. I can't even begin. I'm not even sure of the decade. I just know it was in New York. It was at a Nebula event, and Dave Hartwell introduced us at a party, and we went off for about 10 minutes.
I remember that. I think that was 1991.
That could be. Mm-hmm. And then after that, when you were guest of honor at Capclave, we ran into each other two nights, actually, with a whole bunch of the Capclave people, the night before the convention was going to begin. And there was a great Mets versus St. Louis Cardinals game that a whole bunch of us watched together. With a great
deal. If I was the guest at Capclave, that might have been 2006.
Wow, that long ago. Okay. Yeah, well, we can always figure that out by whenever the Mets were playing the Cardinals in the playoffs. And then you and I actually recorded an interview with people sitting around. It was actually a program item. And it was a lot of fun. And I think that the first book in which trilogy was it had just come out. Science in the Capitol.
Yes.
Yes.
And I was at a disclave, not as a guest of honor, as the first book had come out in 2004. So it might have been then.
Yeah, I don't think it was 9 years ago. I certainly hope it wasn't, because that really gives some proof to the idea that as you age, and you and I are under a year apart, that time moves that much faster.
But that's true. Yeah. Time is flying.
I really don't like that. I object. But at any rate, a couple of congratulations. One on 23-12 doing so magnificently and winning.
Thank you.
The Hugo just a few scant weeks ago, and deservedly so.
To correct you, actually, although it did win the Nebula, it did not win the Hugo a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay. It was the
Nebula. I wish it had.
Right. Right. Well, it should have.
Yes.
and it did win the Nebula, which is gratifying. And you have a new book out, which it was actually Orbit Books that sort of brought us together this time.
And yeah, I am now published by Orbit Books. They're just a wonderful publisher. I'm really enjoying the relationship a lot. I think they I owe a large part of the success of these last two books to them.
Oh, okay. That's nice to hear, because I like them as well, and I like their publicist, Dylan Wright,
yes,
who brokered the meeting. That's the word I was looking for before. And this new book, Shaman, is it Shaman or Shaman?
I say Shaman.
Okay, good.
I hear both, I must say.
Yeah, I usually say Shaman. But again, I've heard both, so I'm never quite sure which is which.
Mm-hmm.
And this is pretty much a brand new release. The official pub date was September 3rd.
Yes.
But before we talk about that, let's just give a little history, because this being bona fide radio as opposed to internet radio, although I'll branch out into that as well, there may be somebody who don't know your work, because Marvel Comics hasn't adapted it into a movie yet. So, the thing that absolutely blew me away, that I think everybody in the world listening to this broadcast, aside from Shaman, must read, is the Mars Trilogy.
That's certainly what I'm best known for, and I think will always be my most popular work, partly because Mars is so popular, partly because it's a 2,000-page novel, a trilogy, in a kind of form that people seem to like.
Yeah.
So, yes, the Mars Trilogy. Still doing well after all these years. It's actually been 22 years since Red Mars came out.
And my God.
Maybe 15 years since Blue Mars came out.
Wow.
But they seem to be wearing well. I mean, aside from the occasional reference to videotape and the like, they seem to be still reading in a somewhat contemporary way for new audiences, which is, of course, really a pleasure, because sometimes that doesn't work with science fiction.
Yeah, well, that actually brings up a question right there, because I know that by the time Blue Mars came out, there were things that were mentioned in Red Mars that where the science had learned a little bit more. I think, like, something about the permafrost had changed, that we knew more, and what was written in the first book was no longer exactly the same.
Well, some few things like that occurred, maybe, but I have to say, I wrote the books at a very lucky moment, because what we knew about Mars then and what we know about it now, there's nothing that we've learned since I wrote the books that that invalidates the trilogy or makes it turn into some kind of fantasy. There has been a lot of speculation about life still alive on Mars, bacterial life deep underground. Well, it's speculative, and just last week, the rover that's working there now discovered a lack of methane signals, and methane would have been a sign of certain kinds of bacterial life outgassing, but it's not there. So it's still up in the air, but it's seeming more and more likely that Mars probably is a dead planet, which is what the Mars trilogy postulated.
Yes.
So aside from that, the amount of water, the constituency of the atmosphere, the chemical nature of the rocks, the ability to terraform it, the topography, it all is exactly the way I had it in the trilogy.
And I thought the most important science in that trilogy was the political science.
Yes. Well, I also got lucky because I included Islamic cultures in a big way in my Martian future. Well, you have to remember that in the early 90s, this wasn't the obvious move. But ever since 2001, we've been much more aware that this global culture of ours has got some really serious cultural differences that are not automatically reconcilable and may go on for, you know, centuries to come without a grand reconciliation. And so the books read as if they are aware of what's happened in this last decade or so. And so that's probably true, what you say, in terms of predicting futures in the way that science fiction is supposed to. I think the books are good on the political and element.
Yeah. And just, you know, the sheer entertainment element, the opening set piece going right through, you know, without giving away any reveals to what happens to our focused character for the first, 50, 70 pages or so alone, that will grab anybody.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that is the old technique of Homer, the in media res, beginning in the middle of the story. It is a very dramatic moment, and then you have to unpack what happened because the story drops back a few decades to lead you up to that moment.
Yeah.
And what I think is interesting about the structure of Red Mars in particular is that the reader begins to become comfortable and think that they're going to be reading the whole novel in a state of knowing what's coming, because they're thinking that the whole novel will be backdrop up to the climactic moment of the first chapter. But in fact, at the end of chapter 5, you are suddenly cast past that moment into an unknown story space. And there's many a reader that has reported to me that they've had to read chapters 6 through 8 in a continuous burst of reading in order to find out what happens next, because they're shocked to be put back in that normal state of narrative uncertainty. So I think it's a good structure. I think it really casts people through the book, even though it's quite a fat one.
Yeah, it does. It remains one of my favorites. If anybody ever backed me into a corner on, you know, what's the best science fiction to read, and they're specifically looking for plausible science fiction. I won't say hard, but plausible science fiction or hard science fiction. That would be in one of the top books I would name.
Yeah, well, thanks. And I like this word plausible as opposed to hard science fiction. I don't like the name hard science fiction. I think it's a subcategory that doesn't actually exist, and it's not something I'm interested in.
Yeah, exactly, because I think it sort of went out of date after Hugo Gernsback.
Well, I actually think the Mars trilogy itself somewhat collapsed the concept of hard science fiction, because hard science fiction before the Mars trilogy was always hard politically in that it was kind of right-wing stuff. And the Mars trilogy is left-wing, and so therefore the idea that hard science fiction could be typed politically fell apart, and after that the whole concept began to look really squishy.
Well,
which is ironic given the name.
Yeah. Well, exactly. But that brings up a whole other question right there about the presence or lack thereof sometimes of progressive politics in science fiction up until a certain point. And I think that you were one of the vanguards, maybe you and Theodore Sturgeon.
Well, that's Theodore Sturgeon puts it back quite a long ways.
Well, that's why I mention him, because I think he was one of the first.
Max Reynolds and Ursula Le Guin, a whole crowd with feminist science fiction and really 60s, the New Wave. The New Wave is, in general, quite progressive. So No, I think there's a long-term tradition that it even includes H.G. Wells and Olaf Stapledon that are relatively, are in any sense, progressive and leftist utopian science fiction.
Yeah, and Fred Pohl comes to mind as well.
Yes, yes, very much so.
So I guess I have to eat those words. But
and Asimov.
And Asimov. But the thing is also that those people were, for the most part, with the exception of Le Guin in books like The Dispossessed, they weren't necessarily writing about something in which politics was of such a great focus. Because when you take a look at the other, quote, hard science fiction, end quote, that existed before that, yes, they were Jerry Pournelle, Robert Heinlein, I'm not quite sure how to categorize Larry Niven, L. Ron Hubbard, people who were at the very least militaristic, although it's hard to define Gordy Dixon, because he's very militaristic, but he's also rather progressive.
Well, yes. I think the most you can say is that science fiction is a really good instrument for discussing politics without being boring, in terms of plots and action and narratives that have a political meaning attached to them that that can be unpacked or decoded and is part of the fun. And it's almost inevitable that if you're going to postulate future societies that you're going to have underlying it as part and parcel of it a sort of political theory of history or a philosophy of history. So this is one of the things that science fiction does. And of course, that being the case, you get the complete spread from the far right to the far left and everything in between.
Yeah. And I guess for some reason, I think of you when I think of that. Maybe it's just that my personal politics, which are progressive slash radical, resonate when I read your work. And I sit there going, yes, this is what I want. This is what I agree with.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's good to be part of that community. It's one of the things I like doing. It's interesting as I go further on in my career, I'm trying to make sure that I am writing novels that can be enjoyed by anybody of any political persuasion. And if people are arguing with it, that's fine, because that's one of the things that science fiction's about, too. I would say that really the Mars books and on from there, they are more and more subtle in their approaches to politics, and maybe I should make an exception for the Science and the Capital trilogy, because being in Washington, D.C., it was hard to be very subtle. But for the rest of my books, and especially I would say in 2312, there is, I think, a wider appeal or a less obvious political agenda, let's put it that way.
As long as we don't define, and I don't define climate change as a political agenda, although there are those who would deny it. And
No, climate change, I think, is a scientific prognosis of great robustness, and basically we're in it already. So it's the response to it that has been politicized, and pretty much during the time while I was writing those books, it became more than before a element of faith in the Republican Party that climate change had to be denied and efforts to mitigate it fought, because mitigating climate change is going to require collective public, i.e. government action. And so just as a matter of political philosophy, they didn't want to agree that the phenomenon existed, because if they agreed that the phenomenon existed, then government action is necessarily involved in the solutions to the problem. So, and also, the polluting of the atmosphere is an economic cheat. It's not being paid for. It's like throwing trash in the streams back in the 50s and 60s. It was, for a while, it was okay to exteriorize your costs and throw your waste into the environment and wreck it for everybody else. Then the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and suddenly it became not okay anymore to pollute with your wastes of your industrial processes. Well, now all businesses and really all of us are doing that without paying the costs. And so paying the costs is something that has to be imposed. It doesn't just come out of free market stimulus. And that is a problem because there are some people who believe that the free market is the only rubric that needs to be applied to human affairs. And it's a fundamentalism, and all the fundamentalisms are deeply flawed and anti-humanist and crazy, I would say. and that's true of all the religious fundamentalisms, but also the economic fundamentalisms. And in this case, we've got to be aware that we've got to act on the climate and that it transcends political beliefs. So, you know, even saying that becomes an intensely political statement, that if a novel says that, then you really have quite a political novel. And so that's just true of Science and the Capital, no matter how I tried to avoid it. And no matter how I tried to make it into a comedy, basically a domestic comedy of families living in America, you know, in this century.
Yeah, we should tell listeners, by the way, that they won't find a book called Science in the Capital. We're talking about 40 Signs of Rain, 50 Degrees Below. That's what just came out when we were at Cap Clave. So, yeah. And 60 Days and Counting are the three books.
Thank you for that. Yes. I always called them Science in the Capital, and it's true that this name appears nowhere except on the internet. It will lead you eventually to the titles. But it's best to think 40, 50, 60.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages, by the way, to doing an interview through Skype, is that I can be browsing and boning up on my memory by using the internet simultaneously. So
nice. Very nice.
Yeah, something I can't do as easily when live on the air because I have to pay attention to engineering in the console and stuff. Skype has its own problems, but you have such a body of work to talk about, and I'm not sure if we want to do the whole thing of naming each one, but we should let people know what we're talking about. And I even jumped from Mars to Science in the Capital. In between that was Antarctica, which is related to the Mars books. And then the Years of Rice and Salt. Antarctica. Now tell people how that came about.
Well, I was doing the research for my Mars books, and Antarctica is the Antarctica. I found out that the National Science Foundation sends artists and writers down there. And so immediately I applied at first for my Mars books, and they said, no, we won't send you. We only send down people who are writing about Antarctica specifically. So I applied again, saying I wanted to write about Antarctica specifically, and they agreed and sent me down there in 1995. As it turns out, I mean, the book comes after the Mars trilogy. It's not connected to the Mars trilogy, really, even though it shares a lot of concerns and is both of them are cold places. But the characters in Antarctica are actually show up as minor characters in the Science in the Capital trilogy. So in a way, Antarctica serves as a kind of unnecessary prelude to the Science in the Capital trilogy. But it's a standalone novel about what it's like down there in Antarctica today. And I'm very pleased to report that it's still kind of the main narrative that people go to when they go to Antarctica. Then they read that novel in order to be brought up to speed and to understand the culture down there better, especially the locals that is to say the people who work down there for entire seasons. then for them, my novel is sort of their story. And so it has a nice ongoing life down there.
Yeah, I remember when you were down there, and this is the very earliest days of the web, although I've been online since the early 80s on the internet, but there was no web. And there were people in Antarctica that were sending out messages through BBSs and stuff about classes in science fiction that you were teaching.
Well, I had a lower profile than that. I was a roving reporter. NSF gave me carte blanche to go where I wanted, and scientists would invite me out to their field stations, and I would helicopter out with extra coffee and be welcomed by scientists who would then let me watch what they do and also help them in ways that I could, very simple things like replacing batteries or screwing in screws, or taking data down as people told it to me. I did work for them, very simple stuff. And then the thing that you may be referring to is that I did have a fairly famous and glorious lecture at McMurdo called Antarctica as Utopia. And I had an enthusiastic crowd of maybe 500 or 800 people, which was about a third of the population of McMurdo at the time. Crowd into the galley, and it was a pretty raucous session as people were amused or horrified to think of Antarctica as it's run right now as a kind of utopia. And so I think that's been remembered, although it was not, I was not professionally recorded, and I don't think it's on the internet. It's usually the case that the best of my talks don't actually make it to the internet. It's, there's some kind of inverse correlation going on there.
Oh, we've got to fix that somehow. How about short stories?
Well,
Jonathan
Strawn edited a best of collection for Nightshade's book. So there's a best of Kim Stanley Robinson, which really just means best of my short stories. And Jonathan did a fantastic job of editing that. He made choices that I wouldn't have been able to make and put them in the right order. And so that, I think now you can get my short stories in a fairly solid collection. It has almost everything I would want people to read out of my short fiction is what it comes down to.
Is there any kind of a preference, or what is the difference between writing the short form versus the long form?
Well,
I was just going to comment that the short form can often take as much work, almost as much work as a novel. And, you know, for that, somebody might get $100 instead of, you know, a living.
Well, that's right. I mean, the business is mainly constructed around novels, which is fine by me because I feel like a novelist. I like working at the scale of a novel. I'm completely in love with the form. And I feel like every time I write a new novel, I'm solving new problems, and I've got some craft built up from the previous novels that allow me to take creative approaches to it. And in short, I'm a novelist, and I love novels. Now, I started by writing short stories, and I certainly enjoyed it while I was doing it. I haven't done it really for 10 years since I finished The Martians, which is a kind of companion set of stories to the Mars trilogy. So, and I do think that short stories are very, very hard. Not that they take as much time, because they definitely don't. But what they do take is an idea that is something that you really can encompass in a short story amount of pages. And those ideas are not easy to come up with. So I would say that I would love to have more short stories, but I not having them appropriate.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I ran away for a second to close a window because, yes, there was a child out there. And then I noticed that we started breaking up, so I'm going to put a mark here and edit that out, and we'll come back here at this point. Because I just wanted to say that some of your short stories were brilliant. And being a radio person, bringing science fiction to the air, short stories are, well, perfect for radio. And it's a little harder to do novels in any way, shape, or form. There was one, and I'm blanking on the title, but it was written well near the end, or I should say before the end of the 20th century, and it was about the beginning of the 21st century. I think a person who was way north, like in Scotland or something.
Oh, yeah. That was called A History of the 20th Century with Illustration.
That was the one. And that story just moved me so much.
Well, thank you. It almost is the last short story I wrote. It came right before the Mars Trilogy, and it ended the streak of short stories I had been writing for about 15 years. So I think as a short story writer, my work comes mostly from the 70s and the 80s, with the single exception of The Martians, which comes from the end of the 90s. And then I wrote one new story for Jonathan Strahan for the Best Of collection about the Berlin Philharmonic that was not a science fiction story.
Ooh.
But I think A History of the 20th Century holds up well as a vision of, you know, kind of macro history.
Yeah, I think so as well. But I also just realized now that I'm going to have to pull something from the Berlin Phil to fill out parts of this radio show. Bernstein conducting, I imagine, but...
Yeah, well, he certainly was guest conductor there often.
Oh, yeah, and a very important one. Either him or Herbert, as Peter Schickley says, Herbert the K.
Yes, well, the story that I wrote is about Wilhelm Furtwängler, Von Karajan's big enemy. And Von Karajan was kind of a Nazi collaborator who got away with it, whereas Furtwängler was a objector who tried to resist the Nazis as best he could from within Germany. So it makes for a very interesting story.
Okay, I haven't read that one, and I'm going to have to now, because I, as musically, I'm a fan of the both of them. And I actually had the impression, I had been told by some, that Furtwängler was the collaborator, and I did not know this about von Karajan.
Yes, it's often misunderstood because Furtwängler was in Germany and was forced to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic throughout the course of the war, but he protected and rescued, they reckon, maybe 100 people who were Jewish or had Jewish affiliations, and he was constantly trying his best to subvert and deny the Nazis, but he never left Germany. So he went through a denazification trial, which, although the prejudice was against him, he was declared innocent as soon as they looked at the whole story of his activities.
Ah, okay.
So after that, he went back to being conductor of the Berlin Phil, and he did it until his retirement, and then von Karajan took over. Now, during the war, von Karajan had been much more of a Nazi supporter, I think a party member. He had to kind of dodge his past in the like von Braun.
How disappointing about von Karajan. I never knew that. And I know people who've actually played for him and said what a delightful person he was. So,
I wouldn't want to go too far. I have the feeling that he has, like Furtwängler, I think he was caught in a wicked situation. And I don't want to condemn him because I don't know the details of his story the way I know the details of Furtwängler. I know that the two men didn't get along.
Yeah.
And they had very different styles. But I don't want to say anything against von Karajan in ignorance, because that's what people have done all along about Furtwängler, and so I don't want to make the same mistake.
Well, the only thing I can really say about Furtwängler is I saw his ring at the Met, and I thought they should have put more on the stage, but the music was magnificent.
Wow. Well, you're a lucky man.
Yeah, I've gone to see two. I've seen the Furtwängler and I've seen the Levine.
Wow.
And the Levine actually is available on high def and well worth people seeing, despite the mechanistic backdrops, the music.
I heard about those.
Oh, yes.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about this, because I struggled to find any short story idea, and then I was listening to the Berlin Philharmonic version of Beethoven's Ninth that was recorded for Hitler's birthday in 1942. And by that time, the bombing of Berlin had begun, the Allied bombing. And I was listening to that as I was running, and I heard the sound of the timpani player, and it seemed to me that he was very distinctly imitating the sound of bombers overhead. And once I heard that, I thought, there's no mistaking that this timpani player is trying to tell people something about what's going on. And it was in the first movement, which is very dark and gloomy anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The more I looked into it, the more I realized I had a short story in a simple description of that very performance. And that's a short story idea as opposed to novel ideas, which are what I'm always having. So you were right. I mean, it took me 3 weeks of intense work to write a very short story. And so it is work intensive, but at least I had a good idea, which I must say I'm searching for more, because what I'd like to do is write novels. And then in between them, in the month or two that I take off, I'd like to pop off a short story or two just to play the game, because it is a good game. But I need ideas to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I'm glad to hear that there may be more in the future, and I wasn't aware of that one, so now I have to get that Stram book.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't mind having to begin with, but I like having a short sharp... No, Martin Green, am I a short, sharp shock?
Yes, well, that has just been brought out as an audio recording, which is great, and also an ebook, which is great, and it should have a new paperback edition, too. So that book continues to have its own life. It's in a peculiar zone, being a novella length or a very long novella or a very short novel that comes out, you know, right before the Mars trilogy. So it was sort of my last gesture towards short fiction and towards dreaminess before I got into the hard historical realities of the Mars book.
Okay. And also, again, we're touching on music because that's, of course, a reference to Gilbert and Sullivan, and I'm a huge GNS fan.
Yes, although, you know, the truth is that I first heard that phrase, it's a short, sharp shock, coming out of the murkiness of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon.
Yes.
Where one of those pub voices is muttering away in the backdrop of one of the techno rock sections of Dark Side of the Moon, and suddenly those words emerge from the murk. It's actually difficult or impossible to hear what else the guy says.
Amazing.
And what I realized is that phrase had migrated from Gilbert and Sullivan from the Mikado into general British usage, so that, like, Thatcher's punitive prison sentences for young people were called a short, sharp shock, and so on. So it's now a common phrase in Britain, and I knew none of that when I chose it for my title.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's one of those things that eventually people will have no idea where it came from.
Yes.
Like
I think that's true already.
Yeah,
although people can track it back, but
I can track it back because I know my Gilbert and Sullivan. But you know,
right.
People have no idea where the term "the whole nine yards" comes from. For example,
where does that come from?
Nobody knows.
Oh yeah, well, also a penny for your thoughts. I mean, that comes from Shakespeare, as so many phrases do. But usually, it's somewhat forgotten.
Yeah, I don't subscribe to a whole lot of listservs. I find them infuriating. But there's one called Phrase of the Week and another one called Worldwide Words, and all they are about are exactly what it says. One is about etymology of words in general, and the other one is about phrases that people don't forget. And a lot of it has as much to do with debunking as with explanation.
Yes. The false etymology is a fun game to deconstruct, etc. I enjoy those myself. I read the OED for fun, and I just find the history of words to be completely fascinating.
Yeah, the listserv, the Worldwide Words, which came out pretty much as the web came out, so it's that old, is from one of the contributors, one of the volunteer contributors to the OED.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he has all of the opinions and all that. The one, the Phrase a Week, which comes from phrases.co.uk, is a bit lighter in tone. And they're both well worth reading and very funny. And if you love etymology, you'll love those two websites or listservs. You can take them either way.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that. I do love those things. In fact, I must say, this maybe this leads into my new book, what Shaman is about, the people who painted the Shobei Cave 32,000 years ago. So it was an oral culture only. They did not have written text at that time, and in fact they were, you know, more than 10,000 years away from it, actually more like 25,000 years away from it. And so I had to think about oral cultures and learn about oral cultures, and what I learned was that proverbs were really, really crucial for passing along common wisdom in a form that could be easily memorized and passed along in a stable form. So I've got many books of proverbs, both of First Peoples and of just modern peoples, because, you know, if you take even English proverbs, a lot of them go right back out of the record into deep time, and turns out that they were written down, but they existed long before they were written down. So it's an interest of mine now, because it was a necessary part of the work on Shaman.
Well, the one thing we haven't discussed is 2312, but since we've started on Shaman, let's talk about it. The Précis of Shaman, and I have to admit, this is one book, I'm only about a quarter of the way through it. I've been delinquent in my reading, because there is just so much to read. But it's Paleolithic.
Yes. Well, I'm. If you people who have been reading my work will have seen a long-term interest in the people who have to live outdoors, primitive cultures, the Paleolithic, sociobiology, in essence, the kind of evolutionary history. And I think it's a very natural science fictional concern. I think of Shaman as a science fiction novel, in that it took the sciences to let us know even what was going on at that time, so that you could do more than just guess. And then also, it's a part of the study of, if you think about science fiction as being what humanity could become, then that question is crucially depends on what we are and what we, how we became what we are. So then you end up looking at the Paleolithic in a natural way. And also, I spend a lot of my spare time backpacking in California, Sierra Nevada, so I'm out there with a fairly simple set of gear. It's by no means a Luddite thing, and it's not a return to primitive conditions. It's actually a sophisticated and high-tech activity, but it is walking around outdoors, and a lot of times in the snow. And doing snow camping is a technical thing with techniques that make you comfortable. So I've been interested all my life, and this was an opportunity to write about it. And it was really the Shobei Cave, that beautiful cave discovered in end of 94, beginning of 95, where they dated it. They found that the paintings are 32,000 years old. Well, that's twice as old as Lascaux and Altamira. And all theories of art history and of human development had to be kind of tossed out the window.
I'm sorry, is this one in France?
Yes, it's in France near the in the Ardèche region, and really fairly near Lascaux and the other caves of southern France.
So this would be the same cave that is covered in the film Cave of Forgotten Dreams?
Yes, that's right. The Herzog movie from 2011 is a beautiful evocation of the cave, and Herzog trusted the cave. It, you know, two-thirds of his imagery are just showing you the paintings themselves without much mediation from filmmaking techniques. And I mean, admittedly, he interviews a lot of loony people, and he has a truly bizarre finish to the movie. But especially now, when you can get it on DVD and you can kind of fast forward through the lunatic interviews, and the images of the cave itself are fantastic. So,
yeah, although it's hard to separate Herzog from the lunatic, because, you know, in his case, it sort of takes one to know one. But
he's a great filmmaker, et cetera, et cetera. But what he likes is to get eccentrics on film and then let them reveal themselves, which that's all very well until you want information about that cave. And then to interview a guy who was a perfume maker who thinks that he can smell caves from afar. This is just a serious waste of film. And a scientist who spends all of his time on screen explaining that he used to ride a unicycle in the circus. These are terrible wastes of film when you want to know, well, what was the paint made of, and how did they live?
I suspect it was a fix-up. I suspect that he came up with a short movie and people said, no, no, to release this, you have to add stuff, and so that stuff crept in. I don't know that to be true, but that's what I like to believe.
Well, I've heard that myself. I've heard that Herzog, when he's making one-hour documentaries in German for German TV, that these really, they're super fine. And when he has to make them an hour and a half for theatrical release, they get a bit filled in with weird stuff. But, and I have to say, despite my complaints, most of the time he's got his camera on the cave walls and you're seeing these outrageously beautiful paintings. And I wanted to write the story of the people who painted that cave because I thought that was the perfect entryway to everything else that I was interested in. So that's what I did. And it was really a lovely experience. And it's kind of nice that I've got the visual aids that, in essence, it's an illustrated novel.
Yeah.
Because at any point you can go online and Google Chauvet Cave and you can get precisely the paintings that I describe my characters painting. So,
and despite the eccentricities, I do recommend that movie.
No, me too. Me too. Well, I think, as Herzog says, who were these people? And then my book is the answer. As much as we can answer it, I think I've given it my best shot. And that
have you sent him a copy of the book?
I am 2 degrees separated from Herzog, and I've sent a copy to Henry Kaiser, my friend, who is close friends with Herzog, and he promised to send it along. So that's as much as I know at this point.
Yeah, it would be nice if we hear back.
Yeah, it would be sweet.
Yeah, it really would. What is... how much can we tell about the plot line without giving away too many reveals?
Good question. I don't know how people think about reveals. I wanted to stay well connected to the realities of their time. So a lot of the story involves daily life and trying to make sure they had enough food to get through the winters and the springs. But I will say that there is an emergency that they have to deal with that is a plot, and I think a very exciting, intense plot. And it has to do, no surprises here, with intertribal rivalries. Which could be the problem of that time. It was by no means a utopian society. I mean, these people were doing what they could to stay alive, and there were norms. There was a very intense culture, which we can tell from their remnants. But there were also problems because if conflicts came up, there really was no sheriff. There was no one to enforce the norms, and at that point, people were making things up and improvising solutions to some quite serious problems. So I have my emergency, take my characters out of their daily life into the breaking of their daily life, and I suppose what you would call an exciting thriller plot.
Yeah, it does go there. I'm just getting to that point in the book. And I'm having a lot of fun reading it, as I always do with your work. It's evocative, and I'm always surprised when I get across it, when I come across it, that so-called, I forgot the phrase I used earlier, not hard science fiction, plausible science fiction, set in a perhaps real world, still can thrill people and exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. And I also, I'm noticing in the responses to this book, Shaman, is there's a little bit of puzzlement as to what is the connection to my science fiction work. And I guess since we have been talking about the science fiction tradition here, it is appropriate to say we could compare it to those planetary romances where a small group of humans end up on a planet where they have very few resources and they've got to survive. And it could be an icy planet, as in, say, The Left Hand of Darkness, or some of the works by Hal Clement, or Michael Moorcock. And that is one of my favorite forms of science fiction. In works like Edgar Pangborn and Jack Vance, the early Le Guin, these planetary romances, the early Joanna Russ, with her Alex stories, to survive in a small group on a planet that is difficult with limited amount of technology and resources, that's a very common science fiction story. Well, that's my story here in Shaman, really, because humans 32,000 years ago had exactly the same DNA we did. They're very sophisticated. They're very high tech. It's just that their tech has to be made up on the spot out of local materials, because that's the way it was.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's these conditions really existed 30,000 years ago in the Ice Age on Earth, I think is an added bonus to what is essentially a kind of planetary romance. So I would highly encourage, obviously, the people who enjoy my future fictions and my other planet fictions to just regard this as very congruent, as one more story in that string of stories.
Yeah, because it does have one genre that nobody will deny it belongs to. It's the fiction of Kim Stanley Robinson.
Yes, that's right. It's a... Yeah, at this point, at my age, I'm a brand of my own. I do what I do, and the people who like it, like it. The people who don't like it, don't like it. It's
all one body of work.
Yes. Yeah, I think that I have been pursuing a kind of program, and I have my abilities and my disabilities. And people know what I'm like now. So I feel at home in the science fiction community. And I also feel like my audience is not exactly the same Venn diagram circle as the science fiction community proper. But, I mean, I feel accepted there. It's my intellectual home. It's my social home. And a lot of my best friends come from the science fiction world. So I'm very comfortable there. But I also think that the stuff that I do with wilderness, with politics, with environmentalism, it gives me a different set of readers in different circles, which is good, too. I like having both.
Yeah, I agree. And it happens to fall politically into my circles, which are, and that of Pacifica Radio, where we're broadcasting, of course. So do you have a Pacifica station near you? I don't know where Davis is.
Oh, sure. KPFK or KPFA.
Oh, okay.
Berkeley, yes.
Yeah, so you're more than familiar with us. We're WBAI in New York, and if Pacifica survives... will continue to be that. Pacifica is in a lot of trouble nowadays, financially. So, yeah. So you know where our politics come from.
Oh, yes. That's another hometown. I mean, that's another circle in the Venn diagram. Leftist politics has been a big part of my readership.
Yeah, and I love that because there are people who justify their reading some of the more right-wing or shoe-thumping writers in a lefty way. People thinking, calling Heinlein a libertarian, when really he was just a conservative.
Well, I don't want to. I think you have to take it book by book, and Heinlein is extremely complicated. I mean, in his young days, he was known as Crazy Bob, and he was a kind of utopian thinker. It's just that the libertarian attitudes are expressed often in his books. No, I wouldn't want to oversimplify, because I think that happens to me, too, and it happens to every writer. There's an attempt made to put a single label on them when actually each book is an exploration of people that don't fit well into any one label.
Yeah.
And so in each novel, especially if you're doing it right in novels, you have characters that believe things. And you as a novelist try to stay a little bit free-floating and labile in that way, so that you're able to completely believe your characters while you're writing those characters, and that you're expressing them and not, they're not just sock puppets for your own theories.
Yeah.
And I think I've done that pretty well, especially in the Mars books and in 2012. But it's hard to see the puppet master behind the scenes that is manipulating the ideological flow. And I think that's important if you're going to do novels that succeed as novels. And I think Heinlein did that fairly often. I would say Moon is a Harsh Mistress is just a great SF novel and not easy to unpack politically.
No, it really isn't. And politically, I'm not sure I don't enjoy it.
Yeah, it's good on many in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. So you're right. He is a complicated character and a moving target. I just find it interesting, given some of his attitudes, how many fierce feminists I know totally defend Heinlein. Joanna Russ certainly was one of them.
That's great.
I attended a panel recently at a ReaderCon, which had as a premise, it wasn't exactly guilty pleasures, but it was how do you read and relate to books that just don't fit in your politics? And there was a woman who is a very fine writer, Yoon Ha Lee, of, I believe, Korean descent, and a fine fantasy writer, and I think some science fiction. And when asked, she started off the panel by saying something along the lines of, you will take my copy of Ender's Game only out of my cold, stiffened hands. And because the books do stand differently sometimes from the writer.
But I don't... Yeah, well, I mean, my personal opinion is that Ender's Game is a bad novel.
I like the short story.
Sure, but the novel is what has superseded it, and I just don't think it's a good novel in novel terms. A weak book, and so we'll see whether the movie... So maybe makes that clear by trying to make it visible, actually exposes the weakness of the story itself. We'll see.
We'll see. But, I have to say, in that series, the book that I like is Speaker for the Dead.
Yeah, I'm not a reader of Card, so I just can't say. But I will say that it's possible to enjoy the work of people whose politics you think are not your politics. I would put forward, usually some time has to pass, so that, say, Balzac, who was an obvious Bourbon royalist, explicitly so, his novels are nevertheless great. Conrad, kind of a reactionary in terms of the politics of his day, his novels are often great. Shakespeare, a hardcore monarchist, in his day, that was probably the sensible position given his alternatives. And also, you have to read off a great number of texts and try to interpret, and you can't be sure. That's probably the way that the artist ought to be thinking, is to not get too deeply partisan in the culture wars of one's own time. But on the other hand, you have to take a stand. Your stories take a stand, and so you can't quite avoid it. You end up revealing a political slant, either that or else you look inconsequential or even just flat incoherent, because you can't truly avoid it. You can make your work not matter by avoiding it at all costs, and you end up being someone like a guy who constructs crossword puzzles. But if you get into what the novel is really about, which is what things mean, well, meaning in human life has a political component to it. And so, in a way, it's unavoidable, and you have to deal.
Yeah, I two questions left. Following up on what you just said, how do you imagine your work to be assessed politically in, say, 50 or 100 years? And let me just start out by saying that when I read, and specifically, again, the Mars trilogy, I didn't sit there saying, oh, boy, these are my politics. This is great progressive lefty work. I sort of realized only after I had finished reading all the books that, wait a minute, these are my politics. This is what I do believe. And the reading of the book didn't immerse me in one political viewpoint. They are the events of the book. Mm-hmm. But taken as a body, yes, one can see that you're a progressive writer, if you don't mind that phrase.
No, I it's one of many. I usually define myself as an American leftist.
Okay.
That's broad band, and it gives me enough leeway to say that I ally myself with a big progressive tradition that I love and I feel has been really important in making the world and America, you know, better, which is obviously still a giant work in progress since there's countervailing currents, let's say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, the main thing would be to say it'll be great if these books are being remembered at all in 50 or 100 years. And so that would already be a good thing.
I think it's inevitable.
Well, I would thank you for that. But I think if it does happen, it will be partly because they have a political a coherence to them and are making a statement about what's happening. And they're also talking about the long-term history of capitalism and how it is going to keep on reaching crises of production and accumulation, in as the classical analyses suggest, and that it's going to change into something else because history keeps changing. And no matter how locked in place it looks right now, because it's unstable and destructive, and it's just, we're going to have to survive it. So there's going to be post-capitalism, and I think that's what people will maybe be interested in, is what did people at the turn of the 20th to 21st century, what did they imagine was even possible as a post-capitalism? And the ones, the writers who tried to explore that, even though it's almost an impossibility to explore it, because our minds aren't well set, our culture hasn't taught us much about imagining this, and we don't have good economic theory. Well, at that point, the books will be a kind of diagnostic, or at this point, you can look back at the great science fiction of the 1950s, and you can say this is what they thought was possible at that time. So now they get read as sort of historical novels. We learn about the 1950s by reading its science fiction. And that, like the great set that Gary Wolfe assembled for Library of America, two-volume set, great science fiction of the 1950s. I think there's 9 books in that two-volume set. Well, that is a tremendous snapshot into the mindset of the 1950s. And so what I kind of hope is that my books might join with the others of my generation in giving a snapshot into what we think right now. And that'll always have a political element to it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the whole economic element, because it was a failure of me not to have done it. We mentioned the ecology and the politics, but obviously, reading your work, the economics are an extremely important text or subtext.
Yes, well, I must say, this is very hard to imagine stories that will illuminate the economic situation or the economics of a future society, to talk about it at any length without going into numbers and without getting into quicksands of of bad understanding on everybody's part, including my own, but also quicksands in narrative terms of what's the plot doing whilst you're explicating all this.
Yeah, well, I think Eric Frank Russell did it well with the big explosion, oh, how many years ago? 50 years ago. He had the great... The novella, I think, was called And Then There Were None, and it was a fix-up as The Big Explosion. And it was all about a planet that has its own barter system and is, of course, in the tradition of the day, visited by Earth, which has an agenda to bring them back into capitalism.
Oh, well, luckily, one of the great things about the Internet is I can grab that book and have it in a couple days.
Yeah. Yeah, assuming we can find it as an ebook. Let me know and I'll get you a copy.
I'm saying that a paperback can be in the mail through Amazon.com or one of the other services pretty quickly.
Yeah, usually. Yeah, it is. And I do recommend that one. I think The Big Explosion is the book length work, but the short story would be And Then There Were None.
Uh-huh. Well, now we're speaking economics, and maybe that is the lead-in to 2312, because one thing I did try for there is to give a kind of economic history of the next 300 years between now and 2312, and suggest that the transition will leave a kind of residual capitalism, but that there will be post-capitalist ways of organizing ourselves, and that they will be new and experimental, they'll be unstable, they'll be in need of defending, and that capitalism won't be happy to be superseded. It will go down fighting, just like feudalism went down fighting, and I mean, I've often said that capitalism itself is a kind of liquefied or liquidified feudalism, that we still aren't out of the feudal order of things. And so 300 years from now, we're not likely to be completely out of the capitalist order of things, but that new forms of organization may come into being. And I tried to describe some of those. So that was a wicked problem. And I think one of the reasons that people like 2312 is that they can watch the story struggle with that stuff, and they can enjoy thinking about it in a exciting science fiction adventure. So that's a rare thing, I think, and one of the reasons that 2312 has had such a great reception.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It was an outstanding book, and I'm glad that it's earned recognition, if not the grand trilogy, as it were, of books. There is no third, really, when it comes to science fiction, only in fantasy. So it's the Hugos and the Nebulas.
Well, that being said, I am a big fan of the Locus Awards, because
people who
take the Locus Award and vote in the Locus Awards are really the professionals in the field, and one's colleagues and the book-selling trade. And so I love the Locus Awards, and 2312 did not win that one either, but it came in first amongst Locus subscribers, which I think is important. And also, there are seven science fiction awards in England and America that 2312 was eligible for. It's not eligible for the Philip K. Dick Award, because that's for paperback originals.
Right.
But for those other seven, which, you know, the Clark Award, the British Science Fiction Award, the Tiptree Award, Locus, Hugo, Nebula, the Campbell Award, the one given out at University of Kansas. Well, 2312 was on the final ballot for all of those.
Oh, wow.
And to me, that was a real sign of robustness, that it appealed across different kinds of criteria and different kinds of audiences. And I don't think there's any book that can say that. I don't think there's any other book that has been on the final ballot of all seven of those awards. So I was proud of that. And although it only took home the Nebula, that one, of course, is my colleagues, and I was super pleased about that one.
Yeah, but in the getting all of those seven, that's really almost the definition of it's an honor to be nominated.
Yes, that's right. I've been saying that a lot.
and the Nebula, which is a peer award, is no minor thing.
Yeah, it really isn't. I was super pleased. And to tell the truth, I went down to San Jose with my wife. I had my friends Terry Bisson and Cecilia Holland and a bunch of other friends there. And they were giving the Grandmaster Award to Gene Wolfe. And so I was able not only to thank the assembled crowd for giving the Best Novel Award, but also able to turn it around and thank Gene Wolfe for being one of my teachers at Clarion and one of the greatest writers that we've ever had. So, and he was there, of course. And so that was a really warm and important night for me.
Yeah, I just couldn't make it to San Jose. I went to the last two in Washington, but I have to more or less keep my Nebula attending to the East Coast financially.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry to not have been there. But congratulations again on that. What more do we want to tell people about 2312 to get them to buy it and read it, other than to say everybody loves it?
Well, I think talking about what it's about, that I've tried to do the solar system and once again make it plausible science fiction so that there's no miracles. And we are stuck with engineering that is at least conceptually within the laws of physics, and yet really push the edge so that it's quite a radical inhabitation of the solar system. They've put a sun shield in there, so they're actually terraforming Venus. They've already terraformed Mars very quickly. And many asteroids, I think maybe 20,000 asteroids, have been hollowed out and set spinning, and there are little societies inside each one, with little ecologies and little collections of animals and plants, so that each one is a kind of terrarium or an aquarium. And within that context also, quantum computers are beginning to become powerful, and quantum computers are seriously different than classical computers, and really begin to bring in that long-term question of artificial intelligence in a new way. I've never believed in artificial intelligence in computers, but I thought if you grant the idea of powerful quantum computers, you might be skirting the edge and certainly getting into very strange territory. So I would say it exists as a kind of a long-term indirect sequel to my Mars books, and it's something I've been doing all my career, is trying to portray the solar system as our neighborhood and our livable human space.
Yeah, and it's also a very different than a lot of your books. And so far as the other books are very often, as we said, in lonely cultures that are straining to keep alive under hard conditions. In 2312, pretty much every piece of the solar system is somehow inhabited.
Yes, that's right. And everything that can be inhabited has been. And so it's a big civilization with problems, balances, and really serious conflicts that are still not rising to the level of open warfare. So there's a lot of diplomacy, and there is a love story. I mean, I must say that the entire thing began as a context to be able to tell the story of a romance between a Mercurial personality and a Saturnine personality. And the joke was that the Mercurial person was from Mercury and the Saturnine person was from Saturn. And at that point, you needed Mercury and Saturn to be inhabited, which really pushed the whole rest of the scenario. So I worked backwards from the initial romance, and I think it's still the heart of the book. And the two characters, I think, are interesting characters, as is their interaction. So it's definitely a kind of everything book, but it's what I think people want when they think of science fiction.
I would agree, but that covers a range, and you've covered much of that in your various books. We're almost out of time in terms of a 90-minute broadcast. Pardon me, but what haven't I covered that we should talk about? I mean, I would love to just do, not, you know, talking with you about other writers like Philip K. Dick and all that, but this show, we don't have the time for that.
Yeah, well, I can say that I'm about, I'm most of the way through a next novel where I am trying out the idea of the multi-generational starship, and it's really proving interesting. So I'll be back to science fiction, and I would say that, well, still reminding people that I think Shaman fits right in there, because something that I've said before that is becoming clearer to me because of people helping me to think about this sequence of books doing now for Orbit is that it looks a little weird to write a book 300 years in the future and then one set 30,000 years in the past. But if you think about where we are right now, it's sort of like a triangulation or a stereo vision of what we are, because way we are both of those things at once. We're already living 300 years in the future because we're in this high-tech civilization that's moving very fast, and almost everything discussed in 2312 is a kind of symbol of what we're doing right now. So in that sense, it's science fiction as surrealism that's talking about our situation right now. And then also at the same time, we're still the same primates that we were 30,000 years ago, with the same DNA, the same brain structures, and the same basic life activities of staying alive and reproducing ourselves and hanging out with each other. That's all the same as it was back in the Paleolithic. So where we are right now is a kind of combination of 2012 and 2012. And that's one of the reasons that the present moment feels so weird in the living of it, is that it is both those things at once. And we have a very difficult time getting the two parts of the stereo image to cohere into a single 3D what we are right now.
Yeah.
So I think that the two books are kind of a diagnostic, and I think that the third book of the Starship book, where people are stuck living inside all the time, that will be very relevant and very symbolic of what we're doing right now. And so I think that basically I'm still hammering away at the same interests and projects that I have been all along. And I'm hoping, actually, I can see it in the commentary and in the sales figures, that there's an audience that is now following me through this adventure and enjoying the ride. And so I'm just super appreciative of readers in general, and my readers in particular.
Yeah, and no, it's a great point. And yes, I have to stress to listeners that you cannot take a look at Shaman and say this is not science fiction, because number one, it doesn't matter. Number two, yes, it is all about that body of work. I love the concept that you said of the triangulation. It makes a lot of sense. But I'll remind people who want to get into the definitions or not that the child ballad, as written by a child series, as written by Gordon R. Dixon, started with historical novels and then moved into the future.
Well, I often say that science fiction is always about history, but it's about the histories that we can never know, because it either takes place in the future or else there are alternative histories, and it's not obvious at first why alternative histories are included with science fiction, even though they are. Well, it's because it's another history that we can't know. And then prehistory is also a history that we can't know, because it really did happen, but we can't know it because we don't have the texts and we only can look at their spear tips. And now they're cave paintings. But by and large, that's a history that's unavailable to us. And so science fiction, it's the reason why you see prehistoric novels all the time in science fiction. And Robert Silverberg or Clifford Simak or William Golding's The Inheritors. There's a really strong tradition of prehistoric fiction. Cecilia Holland's Pillar of the Sky and Peter Dickinson's The Kin. It makes sense. There's actually a conceptual reason why prehistoric fiction is a kind of science fiction, because it's a history we can't really know. So we have to guess, we have to imagine, and it's that speculation that is really at the heart of what science fiction does.
Yeah, so it's another subgenre that perhaps we should be glad hasn't been given a name.
I think that's right, and it sort of has a name. And there are even books now describing all of the prehistoric fiction ever written. And so I'm joining another subgenre there. And the truth is that I would like to try a book in every single subgenre of science fiction, you know, that doesn't strike me as actively wrongheaded. But mostly I'd like to try all of them. And I've ticked a lot of the boxes at this point in my career. And prehistory was one that I've always been interested in. So now I've done that one, too.
No, prehistory is great. I just don't want to hear the term cave punk.
Okay, let's not hear that. Don't even say that.
Yeah,
that
I'll have to cut it out of this broadcast now.
Yes, that would be really bad.
Well, you know what I would love to do? Okay, I'll tell you what. At this point, I think we need to say that we are out of time, and you said some more than one great closing remark there. And so we'll close this broadcast off and hopefully arrange another.
Okay. That sounds good, Jim.
Thank you so much, Stan, for being here.
Oh, thank you, Jim. My pleasure, and I'm looking forward to hearing it and to doing it again.
Yeah. You've been listening to an interview with Kim Stanley Robinson, recorded in September of 2013 on the occasion of one of his books, which was mentioned, of course, in the interview. This is a recorded edition of Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. And once again, let me mention that we have a live reading coming up under the rubric of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And our readers will be Carlos Hernandez and Jennifer Marie Brissett. And it's this coming Tuesday, February 3rd, at Gallery Lala. Doors open for the reading at 6:30. Admission is free. Donations accepted. 138 Sullivan Street.
this has been a recorded edition of Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. You can always write me, jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way shortly. Have a wonderful week and be good to each other.
And you're in tune to Radio Station WBAI, 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org. 2 minutes in front of 3 o'clock. Make that 1 minute in front of 3 o'clock. WBAI. Clock 99 Cinco List Alive WBAI Burn Baby Burn.
The red, white, the blue, I'm not Captain America, too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torture the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works, jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia. Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah. Thinking they slick, contradicting their own, taking me for a fool. They sent my man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game, well I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you, I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire, my desire to burn. What? Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Children laughing at the school yard game.
1990 single is still live until we finish burning in purest red, white, and blue. 5 o'clock. Michael Rose and Lennon Brad. Michael Miguelito Rose, the first artist to be on the U.S. imperialist terrorist list, is performing in Russia. This week in Russia, landed there on Monday. Shows are going great. 212-209-2900 if you're in Russia. And you saw Michael Rose, you know where to call us. 99 single is still alive. Burn, baby, burn. Let me tell you something. This is the no-God zone where we don't believe in any of that stuff. The only thing we do here, make proletariat revolution. Father Bacon style with no apology. You know why? Because we don't want to go back to this. And we can do this permanently. Yeah. True, 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 true. 99 Cinco. 10 minutes after the hour. 10 minutes after 3. Michael Rose in Russia. Tell you something. Oh, it's gotta be real, 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 real cold. On a day like today in a New York City, it's gotta be so cold. Oh my God. It's gotta be so cold. So cold. It's about anywhere between, let's see, 4 and 17 degrees in the New York City area, you know, depending on where you are, right? Yeah. Gonna be really, really cool, ain't it? Ain't it? Ain't it? From the top, hit it back, Lister. Yeah. Ooh. 99 Cinco. Here we go. Off the streets of Brixton, y'all. Terry Wilson, this is for you, y'all.
Come on and reach your hand to another. Yeah, give some help now. In my father's house. House, where there is many a mansion in my father's house. Oh, na na na, oh, in my father's house. Where there is many a mansion in my father's house. Oh, yeah, yeah. Right to this world as I came. Where there is many a mansion in my father's house. Virgins to the wedding, they came that day. Yeah, oil in the lamp. That was the question. 5 of them were wise. 5 of them were foolish. Now 5 left out the door. Tell you so, in my father's house.